Welcome to another edition of Mormonland. I'm managing editor Dave Noyce. I'm here again with our senior religion reporter, Peggy Fletcher Stack. Hi, Peggy.
Hi, Dave.
An afterlife conference is set for June 6th through the 9th in Salt Lake City. It will explore afterlife research, end-of-life care, psychology, theology, and bereavement support. It will be a place where, quote, shamans break bread with scientists. Speakers will cover everything from hospice care and medical research to out-of-body journeys. It was founded in 2010 by Terry Daniel, a hospice chaplain, ordained interfaith minister, and a grief advisor, who argued that the survival of consciousness beyond physical death wasn't represented well enough in traditional forms, such as academic, scientific, or bereavement conferences. She will join us later on the phone from her home in Northern California. But first, we'll hear from Jeff O'Driscoll, an emergency room doctor in Salt Lake City and a Latter-day Saint, who is here to talk about his observations and insights about what is often called near-death experiences. Jeff, welcome.
Good to be here. Thank you.
We're glad to have you here. So, a general question. How did you get interested in this topic?
I really didn't have much interest in it at all for a long time. I stumbled across a couple of books 25 years ago, and I read them and didn't give it much more thought. And then a little over 20 years ago, a man came to the emergency department after being injured in a car crash. He rolled his car in central Utah. It killed his wife and his 14-month-old son, and he ultimately lost his leg and nearly his life. And he was brought to my trauma center where I was on duty. And when I went into the trauma suite to see him, I saw his deceased wife standing above him in the air, supervising his care and communicating her profound gratitude for everything that was being done.
Wow. So that's what you've seen. Have you seen anything else personally?
Oh, I've had many experiences like that in my 25 years in the emergency department. I've seen souls leave their bodies at the time of death and communicated with them before they left this realm.
What do you see? I mean, can you describe what the visual experience is like? I mean,
usually what I see is a form of the person that looks very much like their physical body. Usually, in my experience, they're younger. They're in the prime of their life when they leave their body. But it's clear who they are. And it's always accompanied by this profound flow of knowledge. You know that person. You know their life. It's as if eternity opens up and you have an access to this profound fund of knowledge that flows almost instantaneously. And it reprioritizes all of your life, really. All the trappings of earthly cares fade away and you only see what's most important.
What about patients that have had this experience, or have you come across them also?
Oh, yes. In fact, the person I described, his name's Jeff Olson, and he didn't talk much about his experience for 10 years, but before he even got to my emergency department, he left his body at the scene of the accident before his body was even extricated from the vehicle, and he rose up above the scene of the accident, and he had an encounter with his deceased wife, Tamara. And she told him, you have to go back and raise our son, because there was another 7-year-old son in the car who was not injured. And so he had what we would call a near-death experience. What I had was what we call a shared death experience, where someone else dies, and usually a healthy bystander or a loved one sees and experiences something despite the fact that they're in perfect health and wide awake.
So you've obviously talked to that person. Have you talked to some of these other folks about their experience? Is there a common theme in their experience? Are they people who are open to what is normally described as mystical experiences? Or do you feel like they're kind of randomly selected?
It's really hard to identify a pattern among these people who have such experiences. They span the cultural spectrum, all socioeconomic groups, all religions, all ethnicities. These kind of experiences are described around the world. They do have some common themes. Usually people describe going to some place of profound peace and love. They often describe encountering deceased loved ones. They frequently encounter someone they describe as being divine, or they call them God, or some other divine messenger. They usually come back with a change in their life and their priorities, and often it causes such a dramatic change that they may end up being divorced or losing their jobs or otherwise struggling to function in the world as they regroup with their new awareness.
Actually, I did a story some years ago about the issue of divorce among people who have had these experiences. And tell us about one, not necessarily a divorce, but one that you were telling me about earlier, how a person's life was, his perspective, I believe it was Amish.
Oh, yes. I have a friend who's an emergency nurse in Pennsylvania. And an Amish gentleman came in with a heart attack, and they were actively trying to resuscitate him. They were literally doing chest compressions when she looked up from the gurney and saw across the room in the corner of the room this man standing outside of his body observing what was happening. And they successfully resuscitated him, and she took the opportunity to get to know him afterwards. And he had actually encountered a being whom he referred to as Christ, and he was of German extraction. He was very committed to doing everything right and exact. And he told the person whom he believed to be the Lord that he had tried to do everything right, that he had kept every rule and done everything he knew how to do. And this person, this divine being, looked at him and said, it wasn't about the rules. It was about love. And so when he came back, he had a very different perspective in life and very different priorities.
So, how does your interest in these experiences relate to your beliefs as a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints?
Every experience I've had supports my belief system. I am approached by a lot of people here and in other towns across the country when I speak or attend conferences. They ask that very question, how does it fit with my belief system? And they seem surprised when I tell them that everything I've experienced fits perfectly with my belief system, because that's not always the case. A lot of people come back and they have a real dissonance between what they've believed all their life and what they actually experienced. But I've always believed we were eternal spiritual beings, that we existed before birth and that we continue to exist after death. And so all of these experiences fit perfectly with my beliefs.
What about at the recent General Conference, President Russell M. Nelson spoke about family binding and that sort of thing, sort of a vision of the hereafter as a place where families that have made these commitments are together and others are not. Does any of that connect with your observations or experiences?
I actually struggle sometimes with things that are too dogmatic, things that are too rigid in religious belief systems, because in my experiences, that's not the way I've felt. That's not the experience I've had when I've been in the presence of the divine or out of my body, and I have done that. So I'm not saying it's wrong. It just feels uncomfortable to me when we get too rigid in our interpretation of things.
As if, I guess the, I think Mormon heaven is pretty detailed.
It is pretty detailed. And in fact, you mentioned Terry Daniels earlier. This Jeff Olson I mentioned, whose wife was killed in the car crash, he and I are still good friends. We've been friends for over 20 years. He and I are presenting at the Afterlife Conference. And Terry Daniels was in town recently, and I had dinner with her. This is the first time we'd met in person. And we started talking about some of these things. And she actually asked me to do a presentation at her conference on the Mormon afterlife. So I'm doing a 70-minute presentation detailing the Mormon concept of the afterlife.
And speaking of detailing it, will it be detailed? Or is it more, as you just suggested, a feeling of peace and love? And
oh, no. She asked me to describe the Mormon concept of the afterlife. So I'll be talking about how Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon received the vision, as it was called, that specifically details the Mormon afterlife. They had a visionary experience. Joseph described what he saw. And then he turned to Sydney and said, what do you see? And Sydney says, I see the same. And then he describes some stuff. And then he turns to Joseph and said, what do you see? And Joseph says, I see the same. So they had this mystic experience of how they came to this concept of the afterlife. And then you remember Joseph for many years was terribly troubled that he had been told by all the religious leaders in his age that Alvin, who had died as a young adult, could not go to heaven because he hadn't been baptized.
His brother,
right. His older brother.
His oldest brother, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they're getting ready to dedicate the Kirtland Temple in 1836. They're having a meeting in the temple, and Joseph has a vision of the celestial kingdom. And what was interesting was he saw Alvin there. And so he starts to contemplate, how does Alvin get there if he wasn't baptized? The other thing that's interesting about the vision is he saw his father there. And his father was standing next to him at the time when he's having this vision. So
he was still alive.
He was still alive.
Right.
Right. And so then you get Joseph talking about vicarious ordinance work in 1841. And that leads to a whole other concept about the Mormon afterlife. So I'm going to be detailing not just what it is, but how it came to be and what set it up for those revelations.
So the theology, you're going to talk about what the theology and doctrine is that Mormons would have. So can I ask a question that's sort of a little bit far afield, but have people had this experience who were not believers at all and still end up not being believers?
I'm sure there are. I can't think of any off the top of my head. I have a friend, Eben Alexander. He's a Harvard-trained neurosurgeon. He had a near-death experience when he had a rare form of bacterial meningitis, and he was in a coma for a week. And prior to his experience, he was a strict materialist. He believed that the consciousness was created by the brain. He's a neurosurgeon. Mm-hmm. After his experience, he studied his own medical records and concluded that his brain was far too sick to have constructed the experience he had. And now he believes that the human consciousness exists in spite of the brain, not because of it.
What do you think is a reason that maybe that these things happen? They don't happen to everybody, obviously, but they do happen to at least many by some standard. I mean, you may not know the answer, I realize, but why do you think it sometimes happens?
The short answer is I don't know.
Now give us what you think.
The longer, more speculative answer is I presume that those people, number one, have something to learn, and number two, something to share to teach the rest of us. I have another good friend. Her name's Mary Neal. She's the former head of spine surgery at USC. Now she's a practicing orthopedic surgeon elsewhere. But she had a near-death experience when she was trapped underwater for 30 minutes on a kayaking trip in southern Chile. She came back with a list of things she was to do.
Wow.
So I think there's purpose in them, although I'm not always sure what the purpose is.
Well, so talk a little bit about the International Association of Near-Death Studies and what's happening. And I think that you said the chapter in Utah is pretty big.
The chapter in Utah, when I've attended, and I don't go every time, but they're often in the 100, sometimes 125
They meet
people.
Monthly, right?
And they meet once a month, and they have a website that anybody can look up and find when they meet.
Is it mostly people who have had the experience, or is it people who are studying the experience?
It's mostly people who are interested in the experiences, and almost always the presenter is somebody who's had a near-death experience. And then they have some question and answer and speak about it and try to learn something from it. The organization was founded, I think, about 40 years ago. Raymond Moody, who is a big name in near-death experience study, he's an MD, PhD, and he was involved early on. And Bruce Grayson is another friend who as a psychiatrist, an MD, he headed up the Division of Perceptual Studies at University of Virginia for years. And they had enough collective experience between them that they wanted to form a way to study it more and learn more about it. And now there's chapters all over the country and some internationally as well.
You've written a book on this subject. Tell us a little bit about the book and why you decided to write it.
For 25 years, I didn't speak about my spiritual experiences in the emergency department, and I had many, and some of them were pretty profound. And one day about 2 years ago, I woke up, and I had this strange feeling that for some reason it was okay to talk about it now. And so I started to share with a few individuals and a few small groups. And 6 months later, I'd written my book. It's titled Not Yet. It's available on Amazon, Kindle, and in print. And when I started to share, I learned that people often had questions and wanted to share their own experiences, and I realized that it helped them heal somehow. It spiritually strengthened them, and then I felt like there was purpose in my sharing, so I continued to do so.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you're in medical science, and a doctor. Do your colleagues kind of welcome this, or have you run into skeptics or people who are not believers in this kind of thing, or that, you know, resist this kind of?
I have a few people that are warm to it. There's others that are pretty standoffish about it, and there's others that are frank skeptics and critics. I was trained in traditional Western medicine. I went to medical school right here at the University of Utah and did a residence internship and residency. So this was not something I learned in medical school. This was something I simply experienced. And I never try to defend it to people. I don't feel any obligation to defend it. I'm just sharing my experience. And you don't have to accept it. I don't have to defend it. I'm just sharing what I experienced. Go ahead.
Why do you think that Utah chapter is big? Do you think that there's a propensity, a more openness to these kinds of experiences among possibly Latter-day Saints?
Oh, definitely. The recent history of the church, the last 100 or 200 years, really, the record is rife with people that had these type of experiences. They're written in their journals. They talk about them over the pulpit. People are warm to it because they hear about it all the time.
What should others take from this who haven't had this experience, don't know anyone personally who's had this experience? What can they take from this, if anything?
That's a challenge because everybody receives it differently. And I'm not sure that everybody doesn't receive it exactly the way they're supposed to. And so I invite people to try and connect with themselves and with some divine source, whether they believe in God or whether they believe in meditation or whether they believe in a particular religion. Many people come to me and they say they've never had a spiritual experience and they want to know how to have one. And I tell them, I say, when you get spiritually centered in the morning, whatever you do to get that way, whether it's prayer or meditation or contemplation, ask this one question. What can I do to serve someone else today? And you will have a spiritual experience. You will have an impression or a word or an image in your head or something as simple as an inclination to pick up your phone and text somebody and say, hey, I was thinking about you today. And when you do that, you'll start to grow into your spirituality. You'll become more accustomed to it. And the more often and the better you do it, the better it'll become. I met a crotchety old guy a few weeks ago in Atlanta. And I'd only ever met him once, and he was kind of an ornery sort. And he was a friend of a friend, and that's how I ended up meeting him. And I thought, he's sick. I knew he was sick. He was not going to live long. And a few weeks later, my friend called up and said, yeah, he died. And I said, well, did anything happen? And he said, yeah, I was there. He said he was sleepy and kind of confused, and then he woke up, and he was perfectly lucid, and he sat up, and he said, you have no idea how much God loves his children. And then he laid down and died.
Wow. Are some people just scared when this happens? I would just be frightened.
Most of them not, but really? Occasionally, yeah. And once in a while, somebody describes some dark or unpleasant experience or something that they might even describe as hell. Mm. But those are much less frequent. Mm. A lot of people talk about the Mormons having all these different levels of hell.
Right.
But what they really describe
different
is
levels of heaven.
Different levels of heaven, yeah. Because the lowest level of glory in Mormon theology is the terrestrial kingdom, which says surpasses all understanding and glory, right? And according to the Mormon theology, the only people that go to hell or perdition, if you will, mm-hmm. are the people that absolutely know with certainty the truth and choose to reject it anyway.
Right.
The ones that turn and walk away and say, I don't want to be a part of that, even though I know it's true.
That's
a small number.
Theology says that that's a really small number. Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's all sons. Yeah. Sons of perdition. You know there's no women there.
That's what everyone says. Yep.
The vast majority of people on earth could never qualify for hell in this life because they never have a certain knowledge to walk away from.
Who has that? Like a person who had this kind of experience, that would not equate to certain knowledge.
No.
That's
not
just
usually
a hint.
That's one of the troubles that people struggle with for years. And the average length of time before somebody talks about it is 6 to 7 years, sometimes a decade, before they'll ever really talk about it. And one of the things they struggle with was that real? It's been my experience that they occur much more frequently in the ER in particular, because they're most often happening when the veil's drawn back in some way. And the best and most profound way that the veil's drawn back is at birth and at death. And so if you're in close proximity, you have more of the experiences.
Is it more common with a traumatic death? Or not that you may not know.
Not really.
Or
they've actually studied that. There's some estimates that as much as 5% of the general population will have a near-death experience. That's a lot. The incidence is upwards of 20% in cardiac arrest survivors, people that have had heart attacks. And the major trauma patients that have that die and are resuscitated, it's around 20% as well. In some populations, like dialysis patients, the incidence is quite a bit higher, actually.
Jeff O'Driscoll, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good to be here.
Appreciate it. Mormon Land will be right back.
Hi, it's Jennifer Napier Pierce, editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for listening to our podcasts and reading the great news coverage you find every day in the Trib. Our entire team works so hard to bring you the most in-depth, reliable news around. So, if you already subscribe to this local Pulitzer Prize-winning newspaper, thank you so much. And if you don't yet, help us out. Pick up a digital subscription for just $8 a month. You'll be supporting the important watchdog journalism, entertaining stories, and editorial content from Utah's independent voice. Visit sltrib.com/subscribe for details, and thanks.
So, Terry Daniel, we welcome you now to Mormon Land.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
So this Afterlife conference that's next month, what prompted you to found this conference, which has been going on for almost a decade now?
Yeah. Well, what prompted me to found it was I got interested in hospice work and death studies after my 16-year-old son died from a long, rare degenerative disorder. And I was hearing from a lot of people who were very interested in the afterlife because they were having spiritually transformative, very profound experiences, kind of like Jeff has talked to you about, hearing messages from their loved ones on the other side. And there was a conference for parents who had lost children was coming to my city, and I reached out to them and asked if I could come and be a speaker and talk about, you know, these experiences that people have of receiving these messages. And they said, no, absolutely not. We don't allow topics like that. That's, you know, too out there. It's too spiritual. It borders on religious, and it will upset people. And I then found out that many people that I knew in the field had also been rejected by this conference, so I just knew I had to start my own. And that's basically how it started.
So how has the conference kind of evolved?
Oh, that's a great question. It's interesting because it's been evolving along with me as I evolve. So when it started out, we focused a lot on grief and loss and a lot on, you know, these mystical experiences that people were having. But as the years went by and I became more involved in the academic world, I brought more academics and scientists, doctors, nurses into the conference so that we weren't just kind of out in the mystical realm all the time. I wanted to bring it also to the earth realm. So as I, you know, started working in hospice and chaplaincy, I brought those kinds of teachings in. So that's where it's evolving to. It's got on one end, we have the very, very mystical side where we have shamans and mediums. And then on the other end, we have kind of the three-dimensional scientific side where we have religious scholars and scientific researchers and physicians and nurses. So we've got this big wide range, and that's where it's evolving to, is to to keep it that way, to keep it very diverse so that there's something for everybody.
So is the field growing?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, we kind of call it the death business, but death awareness and the death positive movement is hugely growing. And you probably remember several years ago when something was really popular called death cafes. Are you familiar with that?
No.
It started in England where people were having these gatherings where people would get together and have coffee and cookies and or dinner and talk about death. And it was just a way to get those conversations started so that our culture wouldn't be so fearful about death. And that was really popular. It's kind of died down a little bit now. But we now have, you know, whole new professions emerging, like death doulas, which is based on the idea of a birth doula, which is a midwife. And now there are just thousands and thousands of people training to be death midwives, because when you're born, the midwife helps you come in, and when you're dying, the midwife helps you go out. So it's
is that
a huge
different,
popular trend.
Is that any different than hospice nurses?
Or chaplains?
You know, it's different. That's a good question. It's different than hospice nurses because hospice nurses are too busy to actually do the work that the doula does. The doula sits by your bedside, is not distracted with any other duties, is, you know, has some training in grief counseling, so also works with the family, will create perhaps ceremonies around the dying or lead you in guided meditations. These are all things that nurses are generally not trained to do and definitely don't have time to do on their shift.
What about hospice chaplains? Do they sort of fill that role or is that different also?
No, it's very, very close to a hospice chaplain. The only difference I would say is that, you know, chaplains, the way a chaplain's daily work is, again, they don't have that kind of time. A chaplain is visiting patients all over the place, is in their car going to see patients at home. If it's an inpatient hospice, you know, they do a visit once or twice a day, and they do rounds like a doctor does rounds. And a death doula will attach herself or himself to a family for hours or days at a time, whatever it takes. And, you know, people who are employed on the clock, like a chaplain and nurse, their day just doesn't allow for that kind of personal attention.
Well, what do you think is missing in traditional studies of death and dying?
Death doulas.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
You know, our dream, and when I say our, I mean like all of us who work in this field, is we would love to have someone whose job it is to be a transition guide or a death doula on staff, several of them, in hospitals and nursing homes and hospices where people die, and in the emergency room, in ICU. That's what's missing. And I, you know, I was a hospital chaplain for 3 years, and I was in the emergency room in ICU, and people died, and they died very abruptly, obviously, unexpectedly, or if they were in ICU and it was expected, they're in a room with a lot of noise and nobody's in there with them and nobody's helping them, coaching them how to die. So that's what's missing in clinical settings. Now, in emergency rooms, Jeff may have talked to you about this because he's an ER doctor. Patients don't generally die in the ER. They're patched up really quick and then they're sent to the medical floors and then they die. But when they do die in the ER, it happens so fast, and there's just not enough time to honor the process. There's now something that they're starting to do called the medical moment, and they're teaching ER staff when somebody expires on that table, you stop everything you're doing, and you gather around them, and you meditate, or you say a prayer, or a blessing, or you just stop everything for 2 minutes to honor that death has happened. That doesn't normally happen, so that's something new that we're trying to infuse into the system.
Interesting. And I think I've seen hints of that in different television shows now on doctors and stuff. I'm seeing that a little bit more. I mean, besides just the dramatic moments that they're searching for.
That has been on some television shows. Yeah. I've heard that. So
let me shift. Yeah, let me shift gears a little bit, Terry, and just ask you about another subject that you know something about. Explain for our listeners, what is something that's called toxic theology, and what are your concerns about it?
Oh, this is great. Okay, well, as a grief counselor and as a chaplain over the years, I've seen many people who are really suffering in grief and not really progressing in their healing. And I'm talking about people who 3 years after a loss are still very angry and dysfunctional and aren't sleeping right or eating right, and their relationships are falling apart, and, you know, they just haven't moved along a trajectory of healing. That's something called complicated grief. And a lot of them are in that place because of religious beliefs that do not support healing. And I will give you an example of this. Many people who lose a loved one to suicide believe that it is a sin and the person is going to burn in hell for eternity for suicide. And when you have that belief and your 18-year-old son commits suicide, how do you heal when so much of your energy is wrapped up in being afraid not only that your son is burning in hell forever, but that you will not see him in the afterlife because you're going to a different place than he is? So that's a typical kind of belief that I refer to as a toxic theology that inhibits healing. There are other beliefs like that. For example, I've encountered a lot of people who had a loss that was just terrible, like a shooting, like a kid killed in a school shooting. And they believe that it's a punishment from God, or that it's the work of Satan, or any number of beliefs that sort of prohibit them from really facing the loss and really dealing with it, because they're projecting, they're looking for blame, they're projecting blame outward. Also, the anger. I've heard many people say, I'm so angry, you know, that my loved one was killed by a drunk driver, but I can't be angry because anger comes from Satan and is not acceptable. And, you know, if we're angry, we invite Satan in. So I don't know what Mormons believe about that, but I know that I hear it from a lot of people across the board. And it proves to be, you know, to create more stress, more anxiety, and more difficulty in processing grief.
So, Terry, you were in Salt Lake City not long ago, last month, and you had an experience here. Do you want to share that with our listeners?
Yeah, and I imagine many of your listeners are familiar with that grave site. Many years ago, somebody sent me a picture of this beautiful grave stone. I guess it's made of bronze, and it's a statue of a little boy in a wheelchair, and he's being lifted up out of his wheelchair with his hands looking toward heaven and his eyes looking like he's just being lifted out of that body into heaven. And it was the most beautiful thing I ever saw, because my son was about that age and he was in a wheelchair, and that's the way I've always envisioned his death, that he was just lifted right out of that wheelchair up into the arms of the angels. And so I always had that picture in my mind. And when I was in Salt Lake City last month, I was driving around, wasting some time because I was early for a meeting, and I found myself driving alongside this funky old graveyard, the Salt Lake City Cemetery, I think it's called, and I decided to go in there. And as soon as I drove in, I realized, I bet this is the place where that grave marker is, because I knew it was in Utah. And I happened to see an employee driving along in a little golf cart and asked him if it was there, and of course it was. And so I was able to go there and see it in person, and it was just, it was smaller than I thought it would be. And I just kind of just sat there and just cried over it and picked up some grass and some pine cones and laid it there, and it was just miraculous. And I felt like it was a blessing for the afterlife conference, and I felt that surely my son led me there.
Interesting.
He wanted me to see that.
Do you find, you know, a hospice chaplain and in your field and in your work, that is fear of what's going to happen, not just the unknown, but of, let's say, people feel like, oh, I don't know if I've lived up to whatever my religious dogma teaches and what's going to happen to me. Is that a fear that a lot of people who are dying or their loved ones have?
Absolutely. And it's you know, and it, again, the nurses don't hear this stuff very often because they don't have time to sit with the patients and have these kinds of deep conversations. The chaplains hear it all the time because that's our job. And unless you're trained in spiritual care, you know, you don't really even know how to have a conversation like that with someone. So that's a really big part of chaplaincy is, you know, how do we facilitate that conversation? I'll give you an example. I had a man once who was just diagnosed with a life-threatening disease with no cure. He was 73. And he said to me, I'm a repentant sinner. I'm a strong Christian, but I've lived a really bad life and I've done a lot of really bad stuff, and I'm really afraid that I'm going to go to hell. So what do you say, you know, if you're not trained in spiritual care to something like that?
So what do you say?
So, well, what you do is you try to get him to talk. Instead of really saying anything, you ask questions and reflect back to him. And here's what I do is I try to get people to go back to the essence of their faith. So I say to him, what does your faith tell you? Well, my faith tells me that I'm saved. And, you know, if I follow Jesus and I am repentant, then I will go to heaven. Well, okay, so if you are strong in your faith, then that's what you believe, and you are assured of that, right? And that makes him think, oh, I guess that's right. I guess I'm good to go. But then why am I still doubting? And if I'm doubting, then that means I'm not really strong in my faith. And then you get into this circular reasoning of what is true. If I'm even asking this question, then I'm not faithful enough. And if I am faithful enough, then I know where I'm going. It's a very difficult conversation to have. And there is no answer, of course.
That is difficult.
And you just have to support the person in their dilemma. You know, and you're not supposed to change their thinking or tell them what's true or not, or what's not true, of course. But to just be there for them and help them think through it and talk through it any way that they need to. And it's very hard to not inject your own personal theology, you know. So, you know, I'm interfaith. I don't identify with any particular religious tradition, but I'm knowledgeable about most of them. And I have certain beliefs about what happens when we die and all of that. But when I'm talking to a patient or a client, I leave those beliefs at the door and try to go along with whatever they believe, because that's what I'm there to support them with, not to change them.
So what do you want, what would you like our listeners to take away from this conversation about that?
I'd like them to come to the Afterlife Conference.
Sure.
And so they can find that information at afterlifeconference.com. And we're also giving a $75 discount. So if they go to afterlifeconference.com, click on the 2019 conference and register using the promo code DISCOUNT75, they'll get $75 off on general admission. And emotionally, what I want them to take away is to just, you know, to feel the joy of knowing that there's so much more to this life than this life, you know, that we're here on Earth, have, you know, as incarnate beings having a human physical experience, but we're really spiritual beings. And, you know, any opportunity to explore the world beyond the physical is a beautiful gift. And that's what we try to offer at the Afterlife Conference. And that's the beauty of this work for all of us, regardless of whatever religious tradition that we identify with.
Okay, so is there a message for, like, faith leaders that, I mean, they have their standards and I guess their dogma that they're going to preach. Should they be more aware of how it can affect people, you know, and their views and their, I guess, their their state of mind as far as, you know, their eternal destiny?
That's a wonderful question, and the answer is really simple. Yes, of course they should be more aware of that. You know, and, you know, statistically, there are a lot of studies on this now, and those kinds of beliefs are really starting to fall away in our culture. And I don't have the exact statistics. I can get them for you. You know, that so many fewer people believe in eternal punishment in hell than did a generation ago. And even the idea of, you know, a location called heaven is a belief that's kind of fading away. But even the Catholic Church does not consider suicide a mortal sin anymore. And, you know, the Catholic Church changes all the time. So we want the faith leaders to allow their belief systems to evolve. That would be an ideal situation. And the other thing we have now is, because of the internet, we have exposure to other belief systems and other cosmologies and theologies that we've never learned about before. You can just go online and see what the people in Ghana do for their death rites and their grief rituals. And in China, I mean, every religion, every culture, it's all right there at the push of a button. And I think that that's going to help us develop, us as the human race, develop a more wide-reaching, more inclusive view of spirituality, which ultimately can only help because, you know, religion evolves over time. It's supposed to. It's not supposed to stay the same. And there are those leaders who do not want it to change or evolve. And that's very sad because the world around them is sort of forcing them to let go of those definitions, and they're not, and they're clinging and holding on to it. But it's certainly supposed to change over time. We don't have the same beliefs that we had 10,000 years ago, or 5,000, or even 2,000.
Terry Daniel, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Appreciate it. Our thanks to Jeff O'Driscoll and Terry Daniel, and thanks to Peggy Fletcher-Stack for her coverage. We also thank our producer, Sarah Weber. We remind our listeners that they can keep up on all the happenings in the church by subscribing to our free weekly newsletter. Just go to sltrib.com to sign up. We'll talk again next week on Mormonland.